So, first, many thanks for the invitation to this conference on a wonderful and time-honored topic. The background of this story in relation to consent is my enduring interest in the way in which international organizations have been imagined and constructed as international legal actors and legal spaces ever since the proverbial rise of international organizations. Now, in the context of this conference, my aim then is to briefly sketch to you a development in the operation, very much the formal operation of consent in international law, brought about by the institutionalized environment that has become such a prominent dimension to international legal life. An institutionalized environment is meant to refer both to organizations as a legal actor and to organizations as an institutional space. And I should maybe say that I may sound as if I have a cold, but do not worry, this is not the case, this is because of the air conditioning. So I can assure you it is innocuous. So as we have heard and will hear, the notion of consent appears in many different ways. And in this case, I'm not concerned with questions of consent as a building block in the general sphere or, depending on your lens, in the system of international law. And of course, there are some important questions, for example, regarding legitimacy, as we have already heard this morning. But my starting point is rather consent as an act of the subject. And from here, the notion then may be unpacked further. And arguably, consent then has three facets, at least that's how I see it. They tend to be alternatingly emphasized in legal discourse, but they're not quite, they're rarely articulated as such. There is, first of all, consent as a subjective, this famous psychological condition that is used in international law. I use the term intentional state that is common in philosophy of language. And then secondly, there is consent as an agreed expression of such an intentional psychological state. For those who like the semiotic lens, the act of consent is a sign, and then with two facets, the signifié, the content, and the signifiant, its expression. And then thirdly, there is the facet of consent that is the activation of a particular, to put it shortly, obligation binding the subject. Now, in the, let's say, prototypal legal notion of consent, these facets are closely linked. The intentional state and the expression thereof are taken together as two sides of the same coin, and the effect brought by the consent, for example, the creation, as I said, of some obligation, is close by, both in time and especially in form. And this is so undoubtedly because of the link with the natural person as the original legal actor. Picture one human being giving consent to another in order to create mutual rights and obligations, the precise substance of which they have agreed to. A buys something from B, and all three facets are closed, and in no time the deal is done. Now, my argument then is that in the institutional context, consent has come to be disaggregated, you could say. I will now say a bit more about this. First, about the consent of international organizations themselves, which also Fernando will speak about tomorrow, I think. And second, about the act of consent of other actors within the institutional space of organizations. And I conclude with a few preliminary remarks, I might add, on the implications of this. So first of all, the consent by organizations. The intentional state of consent is a manifestation of the juridical will that is frequently mentioned in law. And philosophically and doctrinarily, such a will in most legal systems serves to operationalize legal agency for the actors admitted to the legal system, including the non-human actors, the corporate entities. So you will notice that will is used here as a general psychological condition and not a particular one, as the term has been used legitimately by Professor Pellet earlier. Now, both facets of the act or the sign of consent, the psychological condition or intentional state to commit to a particular obligation, arrangement or relation on the one hand, and then on the other, the expression thereof, they are equally present, of course, in the whole machinery of international law. And in fact, this duality is borne out by the classic reference in the Vienna Conventions, that mention expression of consent to be bound. So there you, we have the hard proof, so to speak. Now, when it comes to states, the original legal persons, as traditionally in mainstream international law, this has been conceptualized. Philip Allitt, for example, has observed as if governments, let alone states, had determinable states of mind, referring to this will that international legal actors are supposed to have. And Tony Carty has pointed out, I quote, "Orthodox international law proceeds from the assumption that states have a legal conscience, even if it has no workable or operational way to explain how this is supposed to work," end of quote. And it is true that even if the anthropomorphic view of the state was to some extent dismantled by interbellum scholars, international law has remained very much at ease, it seems, with attributing the psychological conditions to states. Witness, for example, I picked any statement, the signed text is the most recent expression of the common will of the parties. This is a little soundbite from the great Sir Humphrey Waldock many years ago. Now, when it comes to international organizations, things are different. And elsewhere, at some point, I've argued how organizations appear as independent actors, yes, but with a thin mechanical international legal personality, you could say, not as a fully fledged international personne morale. And this then is not about the actual possibility of corporate entities such as organizations forming a will. For example, political theory and political philosophy have shown how group agents can be distinct from the sum of their component parts because of a particular decision-making structure. But I'm concerned now with, let's say, the immanent perspective and within the law, the capacity to feel consent as an intentional state. That capacity depends ultimately on the legal imaginary, the legal system in which the actor is situated. Now, my point then is that because of the hesitation to ascribe legally relevant feelings and psychological conditions to international organizations, the underlying intentional state disappears from the act of consent. And this makes logical sense. As a phenomenon in practice, it's a bit harder to demonstrate, and it is actually most clear from what is not there to rebut the logical assumption. For example, in treaty practice, the importance of the intentional state is brought out by the weight that is traditionally given to the state's intention in the interpretation of treaties, or the state's intention to have consented to a juridical agreement rather than a gentleman's agreement. To my knowledge, no cases exist so far in which the intentional state of an international organization has prevailed or even played a role for that matter. Now, when an agreed expression or signifiant of consent is lacking, it is all the more intricate process to establish the underlying intentional state, of course. And this is typically at issue in the ascertainment of opinio iuris as an element of customary international law, as can be gleaned also from the range of words used by the International Court of Justice to describe the notion in relation to states, collected in one of the commentaries or the reports of the special rapporteur for the ILC custom project. So the court uses feeling, belief, deliberate intention, awareness, conviction, general feeling, actual consciousness. So it's quite subjective, let's say. It's quite psychological. And therefore, it may come as no surprise that the ILC in 2018 found a very modest role for international organizations in the formation of custom, with no reference to opinio iuris of organizations, and only one in conclusion 4, paragraph 2, to the independent practice of organizations. So, in my view, this is a clear indication. Then next, a few words on the two things, the act of consent in an institutional space. So organizations themselves consent to international law, and it's a little bit maybe limited to rules consent, as Neff has distinguished, which is mentioned in any case in the paper of Christian Thams. So they consent to international law, but they also constitute an institutional space for the consent of others, of course, mostly states. I for now leave out the consent of let's say the private parties, the non-state entities that came up this morning in the introductory words of Samantha. Now, this institutional space in which states give their consent or perform their act of consent is a less elusive phenomenon than what I just mentioned, the other phenomenon. And it is in fact quite well documented, albeit from other angles. In our story, what is striking is the distance between the consent on the one hand, the expressed consent on the one hand, and its effect as a, and then I'm quoting Matthew Craven, processual trigger providing for the imposition of certain obligations, end of quote, on the other. Consent and the obligations it creates are traditionally closely linked, and distance has been brought in by the institutional context, both in time and in substance. And the latter, because the original object of consent and the normative outcome do not neatly overlap, as in the old days of consensus ad idem, you could say, if only because the latter was unforeseeable at the time of consent. And this was captured early on by the reference to centralization, for example, made by Kelsen in relation to the UN in the 1950s. The institutional space that I mention is epitomized, of course, by the formal framework of international organizations, but it is in reality a shorthand, or it's meant as a shorthand, for a range of institutional spaces, including also less rigorous structures, such as what are sometimes called constitutionalized treaty regimes, such as the European Convention that already came up for human rights. Formal rulemaking, then, in organizations may range where this disaggregation is visible, and the effect comes much later in a different form. This may range from a rationalized treaty-making process. I won't go into that, but the ILO connoisseurs will know what it refers to. This is a wistful quote of Wilfred Jenks, rationalized treaty process, because he was hoping that all the treaty making internationally would use that speedy formula. It ranges from that to majority decision making and the enactment of rules by the organization which are binding on all members, possibly on a resolutive condition. And in the ICAO, the Civil Aviation Organization, where the opting out system originates, standards are adopted or amended by the non-plenary council by 2/3 majority. And comparable procedures for the enactment of regulatory acts exist, for example, in the WHO, several other technical organizations, as many of you know, of course. A similar distance between the original object of consent and the normative outcome can be found in the ongoing development of, as I already mentioned, constitutionalized treaty regimes via decisions of treaty bodies and COP and MOP decisions, as well as in practices of interpretation, such as through the living instrument doctrine by the European Court on Human Rights. With regard to the regulatory acts of organizations that I mentioned before, the, let's say, the most formal form, there is periodic debate as to whether these acts should be considered under the rubric of treaty practice at all. Treaty practice because of their link with the constitutive treaty, of course. And that was the approach of, as you will remember, the Court of First Instance of the European Court in the 2005 Kadi case, before the Grand Chamber in 2008 took a turn and took a very different sort of constitutional approach. But in the context of this little talk, it amounts, of course, to the question as to whether these obligations are based on the consent of member states, or whether, on the other hand, they point to a trend towards non-consensual lawmaking, as some have coined it, for example, Nico Krisch. And the idea of non-consensual lawmaking is attractive, but in my view, not quite settled. Doctrinal statements and discursive practice suggest that the binding character of organizations' regulatory act is generally grounded in the consent ex ante on the part of the members. And such, even if otherwise, the consent element is entirely subsumed in the institutional framework. So much so that actually, but that's a different story, one could bring in the paradigm of the consent of the governed. But that said, even if the preservation of consent as an analytical and doctrinal foundation persists, it doesn't alter the fact that due to the consent's disaggregation between these three facets, great flexibility has been brought to the act of consenting to international law within an institutional space, which is, on the one hand, it is a truism, on the other hand, it is quite remarkable if you look at the past 50, 60 years, maybe, how that has developed. So, what does this mean? What are possible implications? My proposition so far is that consent and its operation is affected by essentially all things institutional. So both when organizations consent to the law and when they offer their space for others to consent to international law. And in all these, and affected because the disaggregation of consent comes about in different ways. And it brings, as I said, to light these three components: the intentional state of consent, the expression thereof, and the processual trigger for normative effect. Now, why is this relevant? You could say this formal and binary language, had it not for good reasons, lost a lot of its persuasive power, and is not the term consent, as we know, generally used to refer to a commitment to law in a full variety of normative shades, rather than this narrow approach that I've just taken. And this is true, and also, perhaps more importantly, we know that in recent decades, social change has been often brought about by moving outside the sphere of formal international law, rather than by adjusting formal international law. So, and this, in fact, explains why informal law, a notion that leaves us to explore, it seems, whether it amounts to law or not, and soft law, a notion which is generally taken to mean non-law, why these have been studied so extensively in recent years. And that then is precisely the reason why I have chosen to focus my brief exploration on of consent as a formal legal tool and as a formal binary notion, because it requires attention as well. Now, one conclusion then is that in relation to international organizations, consent in general terms is moving away from the image of a legal act by the anthropomorphic subject. The disaggregation of consent may be said to bring about a mechanization of consent. This in turn may contribute, I'm now making a sweeping statement, in addition, this in turn may contribute to philosophically opening up the international legal system and in the longer run pave the way for other international stakeholder participants. On a side note, but it's a bit of a different, it's truly a side note, you could argue that even what is happening through the participation of international organizations, a mechanism or a trend is reinforced that was already ongoing with regard to states. If you think of Qatar-Bahrain, the Qatar-Bahrain case where the intentional state of Bahrain was swept off the table because of a focus on the symbolic expression and not on the psychological underlying state, which was more or less confirmed in the Somalia versus Kenya case of 2017, but then there was the 2012 decision of the ITLOS, Bangladesh versus Myanmar, where on the other hand, Myanmar's argument that it had never intended to be bound by a compromis was accepted by the tribunal. So, with regard to states, we're not sure where we stand, where the trend is. But surely, for international organizations, there is this mechanization. That said, this morning, in the introductory words of Professor Besson, it was mentioned that there seem to be perhaps signs, on the other hand, of psychologization. I make it up on the spot, maybe not proper. There are signs of intentional states underlying psychological conditions that are attributed to organizations. You referred to a will of organizations that seem to be mentioned more often. I must say that I'm not entirely certain about this. In my mind, this is more often a tone relevant enough of organizations such as the UN in conducting their policy talks and their statements, that they have the will to do this and that, then the notion, the sort of legal, the hardcore legal notion of will and consent and intention in the creation of relations, altering the normative relations, and really this this particular mechanism. So I'm not so certain that there is a development there, but I may have totally missed it. So I look forward to hearing more about that, to discuss that. So that is all connected to the first conclusion: when organizations express consent, they no longer are taken as an anthropomorphic subject. The second conclusion is that where organizations provide an institutional space for states and other actors, it would seem that in doctrine and discursive practice, as I said, consent persists as a foundation for the creation of obligations. However, the flexibility of mechanisms for the creation of such obligations is considerable, up to a point that some commentators speak of non-consensual lawmaking, where I refrain. And here too, in any case, we could speak of mechanization. And this flexibility is helpful, of course, for the ongoing conceptualization of the publicness of public international law, important to many of us, and the engagement with common concerns. At the same time, still speaking about institutional space, the increase of flexibility and the decrease of predictability may not be helpful for leveling the playing field among powerful states and less powerful states. So this is the important question of who wins, who loses, that also came up this morning already. And it has been pointed out, for example, by Nico Kriesch, that what he calls then non-consensualism, and I might term in a different way, that this creates, I quote, more exclusive decision-making structures, that reduce the number of decision-makers and typically not in an egalitarian fashion, but in a way that entails a loss of control for all but the most powerful players. So this is, of course, the risk always when things become flexible. Now, finally, turning again to the consent of the organizations themselves as such, the language of consent has a strong connotation of legal agency. And I bring in Matthew Craven one more time. It invites us to think about the state in organic terms as a morally autonomous agent capable of pursuing the dictates of its own will. I like this because it's almost 19th century description, and it is in relation to states, but it goes to underscore precisely the relevance of studying consent in relation to organization, and it also points precisely to why it's a challenge, why it has been a challenge for the system, so to speak, to incorporate international organizations. Because as I've argued before, the construction of organizations as legal subjects is closely connected to the role that organizations are allowed to play in international life, much more than to particular institutional legal features. So I will leave it at that. Thank you.